So good morning again. The way I'm going to work today is pretty much the same as the first two times. I'll give my talk and then we'll sit again in the third period. And then at some point, what I'd like to do is open the floor for any comments or thoughts or feelings and also any questions that may come up. And if I can answer them, I'm happy to do that. So last week, I think this is from the practice circle. I took little bullet notes about things that people had said. And is there anybody that minds? I mean, I know everybody heard this, but is there anybody that minds me attaching their name to what I think they said? Okay. And if I'm making it up, let me know. So Chris, you said something to the effect that emptiness was new to you and beyond your pay grade. And the reason for doing this is particularly emptiness, which came up a lot. I'm going to spend some time talking about that. And Stan, you found the idea of emptiness to be confounding. And is Mira here today? Mira said something to the effect that boundless is more potent than emptiness and made reference to sound patterns and rhythms and beat. And Carol also said that it comes through many cultures and that boundlessness was not some solid thing. That was a good way to approach it. So in regards to those, that was one of the reasons that I was asking you to just feel it, listen to it without thinking about it, because now to put the word on it, it really is a boundless sutra if you just become the sutra. Oh, Bill, you made the comparison or the contrast between the mantra way versus the study way of taking this up and mentioned that taking it up cognitively winds up taking it into your head. And Jeff, you had sort of a similar take on it, saying that you have trouble with the abstract concept. So when I prepared this, I tried to include these thoughts in the talk. And I don't know, I think it came up also that it's not easy to pick this up and just listening to one time. So I came across, there's this guy, Roshi Shinzan Young. I don't know if anybody familiar with who he is. But he's an American mindfulness teacher. He's a neuroscientist and a researcher. He once commented on the Heart Sutra and said something to the effect that it takes many lifetimes to understand it. So we shouldn't get discouraged if an hour a week in this lifetime we don't understand it. So it's a nice way of not keeping the shoe too tight. We should just play with it, be open to it, and see where it goes. Now, the first talk had to do with Maha Prajna Paramita Heart Sutra. And the way that I'm going to go through this, having a couple of guides. One is the Infinite Circle and Thich Nhat Hanh's Heart Sutra and a couple of other things that are in my head and I don't remember where they came from anymore. So the lines today are the first three if you have the sutra in front of you. And the lines are Avalokiteshvara, Bodhisattva, doing deep Prajnaparamita, clearly saw emptiness of all the five conditions, thus completely relieving misfortune and pain. So Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva, Avalokiteshvara is the manifestation of wisdom, prajna or wisdom. And a bodhisattva is one who has attained this wisdom, but in service of others lives the wisdom out in the world. And this is the 100-foot pole koan that I mentioned from time to time. One way to look at that koan is climbing. It says, what do you do? The question is, what do you do when you get to the top of a 100-foot pole? And one way to see that is when you get to the top of the pole, you keep climbing. And that's because enlightenment doesn't have a beginning and end. We constantly are climbing the 100-foot pole. And the other take on it is when you get to the top, when you get enlightened, you step off and go back into the world and live out that enlightened state. And that's what a bodhisattva is. A bodhisattva is one who does not stop at realization, who does not stop at the top of the pole. They go beyond themselves into the world. So then the next part of that is doing deep prajna paramita. And what that means in a nutshell is doing deep prajna paramita is, as I was just talking about, living out wisdom and compassion in the world. Now, here is the hot potato, as they say. Clearly saw emptiness of all the five conditions. So this is the first point at which the word emptiness appears. And I've mentioned this, that the Heart Sutra, the heart of the Heart Sutra is emptiness, is an expression of emptiness. So this brings me to a crossroad. I always kid with my friend Ray Roshi Chichetti that he's the grandfather and I'm the grandmother. He's the teacher with the stick. And I'm the teacher with, oh, it's going to be okay. Just try and sit up straight. You know. So he's the grandfather and I'm the grandmother. So if I was the grandfather this morning and I wanted to explain emptiness, so that's one shoot. The other, well, and part of that shoot is, it could say it in five words, what emptiness is. And it's having no notions is emptiness. Right? Without going beyond that with a long talk, I could just say having no notions, three words, that's emptiness. But being the grandmother that I am, I'm going to go on. So emptiness, if you understand it from that point of view, that it is no notions. It's when you're in the world with no notions. You have an empty mind, right? And what that means is you have a mind that's empty of notions. And if you think about it, from the moment we are born, and more closely when we become, when we make the statement, I, one thing or another, our mind has begun creating notions, notions about all sorts of different things, and then making comparisons to those notions, and having favorite notions, and notions that we push away, and then they, out of those notions come beliefs, and then we join with other people who share those beliefs, and that's how it unfolds, right? That's the side of the world of thinking. It's also the side of the world that's duality. If I like something, there's going to be something that I dislike. And so it goes. And the result of all of this is that these notions are who we are. Who are you? Well, one way to answer that question is to sit down for an hour and tell people about your beliefs and your thoughts and all the rest of it. And that would be one expression of who you are. And another expression of who or we are is empty. You know, it's free of all those notions, all those ideas. Now, the other thing that happens is that these notions and ideas are creating our reality. They're the filter through which we see the world. You know, if we have one religious persuasion, we're likely to see the world through the guidelines and the dictums, etc., of that particular religion, as opposed to another religion. And some religions can be very rigid, and that if you don't believe in this list of do's and don'ts, then you're considered a heathen. You know, you're pushed outside. And about all other things, about politics, about relationships, about the environment, and on and on and on, we view these things through the filters that we have created by our experiences. It's sort of like if you've ever picked up somebody else's glasses and you put the glasses on, and it's very hard really to see. But now in terms of this metaphor, over the passage of time, you've put these glasses on and we're no longer able to see the world directly and clearly. So the practice is to find a way to take the glasses off, to take the concepts off and just see clearly and directly. Now, this is a haiku I wrote as another metaphor, I guess, to understand this, or maybe more directly than that. And it's, how beautiful the daffodils left unnamed. How beautiful the daffodils left unnamed. And that points out there's a difference between the experience of seeing the flowers and immediately connecting thoughts to it. You know, like, wow, who planted them here? How did they get here? Maybe it was blown by the wind. Or, you know, I don't like this particular color. I like yellow. And the mind starts endlessly, almost in an instant, introducing thoughts and ideas and concepts. And again, that's putting the glasses back on and not really being able to see a daffodil. So if we take the glasses off, if we leave our notions aside, if we empty ourselves, that daffodil, even if the name drops away, is something very different. And in my experience, very beautiful when my mind is quiet. So one of the ways that we say this in Zen, there is justice. Just pouring a cup of tea. Emptiness also is empty of self. So when we are in this place of emptiness where we've emptied all notions, one of the notions that we empty is, that I would empty is, there is a Carl, right? Even that goes, right? There is no Carl. This is a Basho haiku. Sitting quietly, doing nothing. Spring comes and the grass grows by itself. So sitting quietly, doing nothing, that's an empty mind. Sitting quietly, doing nothing. Spring comes and grass grows by itself. Another justice. No story put on top of it. Just spring comes, the grass grows. Sitting quietly and doing nothing. Spring comes and the grass grows by itself. And in this place of doing nothing, when there are no notions, we are the grass. We are the doing nothing. We are spring. And that place, when the notions are gone, emptiness is its oneness. Everybody knows, I think, the Korean Zen master Sun Sanim. He used to use mind makes in just about every talk. Mind makes. So that's what I'm talking about. That mind makes, mind creates, mind presents the obstacles toward having the experience of empty, being empty. So the mind makes, but we don't have to hold on to those thoughts, those ideas, those notions. We can hold them and let them go. So in terms of what you were talking about, Stan, what I'm talking about really cannot be understood. I mean, you can understand the words and the concepts and we could have an intellectual discussion about it. But to really get it is to have the experience of something with notion free, where you're not there, there's no observer present, there's nothing being named, you know, it's just like that. So that's why working with emptiness, sitting with emptiness is confounding. It can't be understood. In the end, it's got to be something that is experienced. Now, in the practice of Zen, we have some methods to help us. And the one that we're most familiar with, of course, is Zazen. And if we practice Zazen faithfully day after day through time, what naturally happens is our mind becomes more and more still. And so the more still our mind is, the more likely we are to see or have glimpses that are not bound to notions. And then another one is the koan. Most of us, when we start out koan practice, try to figure it out. Read some books. Okay, so what does this book say about mu? You know, you talk to friends, you know, your fellow travelers. What do you think about mu? And then you go into the teacher and he looks at you with a sly smile and rings the bell. Because he knows, or she knows, that you're trying to approach mu with notions. So mu is deliberately designed, or any koan, to be confounding, to stop thought and require taking it up in a different way. Now, if I was a real grandmother, I'd explain to you how to cheat, but I'm not going to do that. And then the other one that I thought of was, which is what I was hoping that some of you would do with the chant this morning, is to just receive it as a mantra. That's actually how I worked with mu. It was, you know, it was just my breath. My out breath was just, or if you listen to the Heart Sutra, or just the sound of the chant. And then every now and then, a word that I was familiar with would come in, but it was just this sort of this energy and just becoming one with this energy is very similar to a mantra. So that's it for emptiness of all the five conditions. So what are the five conditions? The five conditions are also referred to as aggregates or skandhas. And the five conditions begin with sense, and then feeling, reaction, interpretation, and story. Now, these are represented in many different ways. They're spoken about in many different ways. This is the one that I'm choosing because, to me, it relates to words that I'm familiar with, and I can connect to it right away. So this is important to me, that it is through the senses that these senses determine the information that we use to determine who we are and how we define and experience the world, right? There's these five things, or all this input of information that we take in. So the senses are, the five conditions are sense, and that's information perceived by the senses, sight, smell, hearing, taste, touch, right? We take that information in, that becomes part of our relationship with what we call outside us. And then there's feeling, and that's an emotional state that occurs in relation to the other four conditions. I won't go into the whole thing, but if we, for instance, smelled something and we don't like it, right? We might have an emotional response to that. That's awful. Makes me sick. I feel angry that you offered me this. So the third one is reaction. We have a response to a situation. The fourth is interpretation. It's an explaining the meaning of something, right? We make up some explanation for what happened. And then the fifth is the story that we make up about our experiences. And I'll say a little bit more about that because I think that's important. But let me just go back and try and give a quick example of how these go together. So there is a loud sound that occurs, and I have a physiological startle response. I interpret this sound as threatening, and I tell myself what a wimp I am for jumping and getting scared. And then I maintain the story that I have about myself as not being a real man in relation to all this, and I feel shame and anger for that. I get on myself. I tell myself, you're not a real man in relation to what's unfolding. And as a result of that, I have the feelings of shame and anger. So that's just a very simple example of how these five things come together, and they inform us about the world that we think is outside ourselves. And so, just by example, but I'll just say it, that all these conditions are interconnected. They don't happen independently. As soon as one happens, well, it's like the Indira's net. As soon as you wiggle one part, all the other parts shake to varying degrees. And a lot of this is important also, a lot of this takes place out of our awareness. We really can be very much a product of our experience of the world through these different senses and not even be aware that they're shaping the being that we are. And then the last part, so it's Avalokitesh Bodhisattva, doing deep Prajnaparamita, clearly saw emptiness of all five conditions, thus completely relieving misfortune and pain. Now, that is not a literal statement. Even if you have total, or whatever this is, total and complete insight, it doesn't mean that there's not going to be pain in our lives. Right? That's not what is meant by those lines. And a lot of us thought that when we started out in practice, that that was what was going to happen. You know, life was then somehow, you know, I remember back in the 60s, it was going to be like a good joint. You know, everything was going to be just so high and wonderful, and life would be one big wow, man. So if any of you were from my generation, I think you can grok to those particular words. So it's not a literal statement. It's not that we don't have any more problems or we don't have pains. But it is an opportunity to learn how to deal with the pain we're in. And there's a very important connection between pain and suffering, because they're different. Suffering is what we tell ourselves about the pain that we're in. You know, we can make up a story, or we can tell ourselves, well, okay, it's a lot of pain, I hate it, it sucks, but I have a feeling that I can learn something from this. Versus, oh my God, it's just never over. Why is it always me? Nobody, you know, that kind of story. Those kind of the outcomes from those two different stories is going to be very different. And it's going to have our experience of the actual pain be very different. And I think in my own experience, the pain is much more intense if I tell myself a story like the second one. Now, you've heard this before, but it's important to repeat that if we have acquired wisdom, even a taste of wisdom, wisdom being that we have some sense that we are connected to everything, that we are really one, one beyond the words of oneness. So we're much more likely to realize that someone else's pain is our pain and vice versa. And this is from Bernie Glassman. He says, if I cut my left hand and blood starts squirting out of it, my right hand doesn't look over and say, oh boy, that's too bad. That must really hurt. What happens is the right hand feels the pain and responds immediately to stop the bleeding. There isn't any deciding. The right hand doesn't look at the clock and think, do I have time for this right now? If we are functioning as just one body, we respond immediately because that pain is our pain. And then the last thing that I'll throw in here in terms of relieving pain or working, I think, with pain is better than using the word relieving, is one of the most profound ways that we experience pain in our lives is our inability to accept impermanence. But we're not victims. We can work with impermanence. And we can reduce the pain that we create for ourselves. It doesn't happen to us. We create the pain by the way in which we, again, talk to ourselves about the pain that comes from things being impermanent. So thank you for listening. It's a little longer than I wanted it to be.